Bluegrass Jam Along is proud to be sponsored by Collings Guitars and Mandolins, each and every one built from the sound up in Austin, Texas. This episode is also brought to you by Peghead Nation, the home of roots music instruction. If you want to improve your playing, join me and thousands of other pickers getting better every day at pegheadnation.com.
Hey, this is Chris Eldridge, and you are listening to Bluegrass Jam Along, the podcast for anyone and everyone who plays bluegrass.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another week of Bluegrass Jam Along. And as you've already gathered from the intro, my guest this week is Chris Eldridge. Chris is not only a great guitar player, he's also a great guitar player in my favourite band in the world, Punch Brothers. And I love his playing with Punch Brothers. I love his playing with the duet stuff he does with Julian Large. I just also really enjoy listening to interviews with Chris and hearing him chat about music, about playing the guitar, about teaching, about kind of, you know, this. It's got a really sort of deep sense of what all this is about, but also is just incredibly open and approachable, and, you know, just it's not often you talk to somebody that you don't know and feel like you could talk to them for another hour after you've finished, and, you know, it feels like just talking to a friend. And that's what this interview felt like. It's a real treat for me and a real pleasure, and I think there's some great stuff in here that you guys will all enjoy too. So I'm going to crack on and let you listen to the interview with Chris Eldridge. Here we go. So, Chris Eldridge, welcome to Bluegrass Jam Along.
Oh, thank you for having me. Very happy to be here.
It's really cool to have you here. It reminds me of something I heard you say on another interview. One of the joys of doing this podcast and talking to people in the bluegrass world is that people in the bluegrass world aren't that hard to get hold of because they're all kind of regular people. But I remember you saying in another interview about that generation of sort of Tony and Baylor and Jerry Douglas, and you described them as superheroes, the guys who wore invisible capes that only you and your friends could see. And I love that idea that there are people like you are the guitarist in my favorite band in the world. And here we are having a chat, and it's just, yeah, it's a treat for me. So,
oh, cool. Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here. And that is one of the beautiful things about our little kind of world of music, the bluegrass world, is that bluegrass as a music form is kind of something that is shared among people. You know, just by its very nature, it's pretty social. You can go to a bluegrass festival and hang out by a campfire and, you know, meet somebody for the first time and play tunes with them for 5 hours and you've never met before, but there's just something baked into the music about it being very kind of community oriented, and there's common material. And I think that sort of just extends to the culture of it as well.
Yeah, and there's something incredibly grounding about going to a festival and knowing that the people you see headlining on the main stage may well be doing a workshop in front of 150 people in a little tent the next day. There's not that sort of barrier between, you know, and you know that half the audience at least are going to be musicians as well. And so there's not that divide of us and them. It's just sort of all us, really.
Well, yeah, that's totally true. And also, like, most of the musicians that you saw on stage probably grew up hanging out with their heroes, you know, who would pick a tune with them every now and then. You know, there's very much, I think everybody who's kind of been on stage has kind of been in that situation too, where they were, you know, if not able to become close to their people, at least meet them and maybe even play a tune with them. You know, that's something that's really kind of unique. I can't really imagine doing that with, you know, Radiohead. It's not... Yeah. But it's hard to get a hold of Tom York. You know, and Johnny Greenwood has not been returning my calls lately, so.
And there's probably, like, reasons for their mental health. Well, that's probably quite a good thing with the amount of people who would want to talk to them, you know.
Absolutely.
It's a different world, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a different world. It's not exactly planned obsolescence. I don't know how we would transfer that over to the bluegrass thing, but, you know, planned... what's the word? I'm blanking on it. But anyway, yeah, there aren't a lot of us.
Yeah. No, it's cool. So what I'd love to talk about is Punch Brothers' new record, Hell on Church Street, and how it came about. Because I think the same interview that I heard you talking about superheroes with invisible capes, you were also asked about your Desert Island Discs, and without any hesitation whatsoever, Church Street Blues was top of your list. So to cover a whole record is quite an undertaking. And to cover your favourite record is quite an undertaking. And to be the guitarist in a band that covers a record of that type is also quite a thing. And I'm just curious to know how it came about, like how you ended up going the whole hog and going, well, let's just do the whole record.
Well, we'd been planning on, so Punch Brothers schedules things pretty far out in advance just because everybody's very busy. Mm-hmm. And so 2021 was going to be a pretty busy Punch year, and we were going to, and 2020 was going to be a year that we made a new record. We were going to get together. We had plans kind of throughout the summer and fall to get together and work on music and write music. And of course, the pandemic came and got involved, and that wasn't really an option, especially in the early days. Of course, there were no vaccines, but we also didn't know that much about it. Noam had just had a baby in July, so they were kind of keeping it extra tight around that. And other people have kids, so we just didn't have the freedom to get together and work the way we were going to. And typically for Punch Brothers, you know, we put a lot of time in on music before anybody else hears it. I mean, just the process of writing and arranging our music is something that kind of happens by committee. It's happened, but it's somewhat unusual for someone to show up. And that, if it's ever a someone, it's pretty much always Thiele, you know, and the handful of times that that's happened. But to just show up and be like, okay, I've got a song, let me show you how it goes. Like, yeah. We don't really work like that. And so for us to have the time together to just hash this stuff out, typically, you know, I bet we spend a month, you know, doing that, 6 weeks. Of just getting in a room together and sitting in a room and just working on it all day, every day. And that's, you know, and the thing about Punch Brothers too, is that the way we kind of play as an ensemble, I kind of feel like the arranging is almost equally important in terms of how our music works, mm-hmm. To the songs themselves. And it's part of the reason that, you know, people very rarely cover Punch Brothers songs is because they're not songs that lend themselves well to that. Like, hear the chords, hear somebody sing the melody around the campfire. It's the conception of it all definitely includes the ensemble as kind of a core piece of what that music is about. And so we kind of have to do it that way. Like, the songs don't really become themselves until, I feel like they're written and arranged sort of simultaneously. And those two things are sort of equally important to the final output. Okay, so all of that said, we just didn't have time to do our usual thing to get together. Mm-hmm. But we did want to make a record. And we were just kind of brainstorming, like, okay, well, what could we do that would still be something we could really get behind artistically, but with the constraint of our time is really quite limited. Mm. We just don't have the same freedom that we usually have to work on this stuff. And we threw out a bunch of ideas, but we kind of started thinking about, well, maybe we could do a kind of record of other people's songs. Maybe we don't have to write these things. Because typically, actually, we can throw covers together very quickly. It's like the arranging part. It's funny. It takes forever when it's our music, but you know, a lot of our, like when we did Kid A by Radiohead, I mean, that was, we kind of just mentioned what, you know, how we might divvy up the parts before we did that at, Telluride. And what was that? Like, it was like, 2009, I think. We did a set. It was our first kind of, also in tribute to Tony, we did this set called Punch Brothers Plays and Sings Bluegrass.
Right.
And because we'd already done our thing the year before and we didn't have a new record out. So we said, okay, let's do this. Like, let's do an actual bluegrass set. Or, you know, insofar as we do it. But as a compliment, because we're crazy, we always play this thing called Nightgrass at Telluride. We close down the festival every Sunday night, and we've done it for the last 14 years. It's a tradition. And so for Nightgrass, we said, okay, if we're going to do all bluegrass, let's do an all Radiohead Nightgrass set. Like, that might be a fun thing to do. So we learned like a million Radiohead songs. And most of them we'd learned beforehand. We used to do these crazy shows in the first year after Paul joined the band. And the first year we all lived in New York, called P Bingo Night. And there's this amazing little club, in the Lower East Side of Manhattan that was called The Living Room. And it was really great. I mean, you could maybe fit 150 people in there. Maybe not even that many, maybe 100. But that was kind of our little spot. And, you know, when we first started out, when we all moved to the city, it was like, okay, we're going to be a real band now. We're going to have a weekly residency. And of course, you know, the first week took us like 6 days of all day rehearsals, you know, to get the music together. We're like, okay, that's not going to work. We got to do this every other week. And that, you know, of course we probably just spent 10 days, you know, between, cause we work a lot. So anyway, we got together a bunch of this Radiohead and bluegrass music for one of those, for the last P Bingo Night we ever did, but we failed to get, Kid A together, for P Bingo. We just said, we'll figure it out when we get to Telluride, but it was pretty straightforward. A lot of times with cover songs, you might have an idea of, you know, how the different parts are functioning. And that's part of the reason that you would cover a song is that, you know, you can get in there and try and learn how it ticks. If you have to cover it, then you have to understand why it's working the way it is. And so how do you do that? You have to like pull it apart and put it back together. And so we kind of just said, all right, I'll cover this part. I'll do that. You do this. And we showed up and probably arranged that as a band in like 15 minutes because all the parts were already there. I was like, okay, I'm going to do the da 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 da. And, you know, Thiele was going to be the drummer and Paul was going to be Tom York, but bowing it on his bass. Noam already had figured out that keyboard part. So that's kind of how we did that. By the way, I've just gone on, I just went on like five tangents. I don't even remember what our original question was. Oh, right. We were talking about getting music together and the idea of covering things and how we can do it usually fairly quickly because we had time constraints for this new Punch record. So we threw out a bunch of ideas and thought, well, just a covers record, that would be cool. And actually people have been asking us to do that for years, but we wanted to have it, we wanted some sort of theme to be there. We wanted it to be kind of united by something, you know, not just a bunch of songs. And the idea of reimagining a record came up. And we'd actually, at Rocky Grass, great people who also put on Planet Bluegrass, or put on Telluride, Planet Bluegrass is the name of those guys. We did a Plays and Sings Bluegrass set, which is something we've only ever done for the Planet Bluegrass folks. We've probably done it four or five times now. And for that, we covered Church Street Blues. Again, came up with very spontaneously. I mean, it was like that afternoon we kind of reimagined some of those songs and played the show. And it was really fun. It was clear that audience knew and loved that record. And it felt really special. Those songs are so well curated. And of course, Tony is such an icon and an influence on all of us individually. You know, and it's just one guy, you know, well, with the exception of Wyatt on a couple of tracks, but just one guy and a guitar, singing these songs in this very stripped down way that he put a real stamp on. So everything about that kind of suggested to us, like, well, this would be a killer record to kind of reimagine. We all love it. The songs are great. It's a way to interact with this beautiful piece of art that we already love so much and means so much to us. And honestly, for it to be a tribute to Tony, who was still very much alive at that point, it wasn't in memorial record that Tony was there and we were psyched to, share it with him. I always want to mention that in interviews because I feel like it kind of, it changes the context in which people might understand the record. This isn't like a Tony just passed away, so we're going to do this thing. It was a living tribute. And so that was that. We had about, I don't know, maybe 2.5, 3 weeks. I'm not sure from kind of the first day we all landed in Nashville till when everybody went home. And we, you know, we reimagined some of the songs. Like when we did Church Street Blues at Rocky Grass, the song, we basically just played it the way Tony played it, but with a band.
Yeah.
Which was fun. I actually sang it. I don't know if I've ever been that nervous. I really didn't do a very good job because I was stepping up to do that, as you said, as a guitar player. And like, and I don't sing much in the band anyway. I've never been one who felt particularly like I wanted to be just in the spotlight for more than just a short amount of time. So I was like, I couldn't breathe. It was not the finest version of Church Street Blues I've ever sung. But anyway, we did that one. But a few of them, we just kind of really did reimagine there and then. And with some extra time, we really got to get in there with the rest of them and really kind of try to make them our own. Because I'm sorry, I'm talking a whole lot without letting you interject. But one of the big things that Tony really taught us by example and me personally as my mentor, which he really was at kind of a crucial point in my development, was that you have to be yourself. You got to do things the way only you can do them. That's kind of where it's at. I think in a way he was kind of flattered when he realized that, you know, people would study his thing and imitate him. I think part of him appreciated that because it's obviously a really nice thing. It's a validation of what you've done. But at the same time, I know for a fact that it drove him crazy, and he didn't on this other side of him just didn't want to hear that, didn't want to hear people doing that. He wanted to hear people being themselves and being unique. And that was something that he and I talked about a lot. Because at that point in time, when I was younger, I could really play Tony like Tony. I can't anymore. I can't even come close anymore. But at a certain point I was pretty good at it. And he kind of was like, I beat you to it. Like, I've already done that. Like, you need to kind of find yourself. You need to sound like you. And he told me that his ability to sound like himself, you know, when he was young, he wanted to play like Clarence White. And he said, at a certain point, I just realized I couldn't. I just could never be Clarence. And there were things, I had weaknesses that wouldn't allow me to be like Clarence. And of course, you know, in those weaknesses, he found his strengths. And then, you know, look what he became and what he did. He kind of became the I would argue the all-time most important figure in bluegrass guitar. I kind of redefined not only bluegrass guitar, created this whole vocabulary you could use, elevated everybody he played with. But he also changed the music and kind of ushered it into its modern form. I'd kind of argue more than anybody.
And I think that's a really cool point to make. And I think it's a point that should be made more, is that, I know exactly what you said about Tony. I read in an interview, he was saying, you know, I sounded like I sound because I tried to sound like Clarence and couldn't quite do it. And so I found my own thing. And that's your job as a musician, is to show up authentically as you, as a human being, expressed in musical form. That's your job. That's the point of being a musician, is to communicate something of who you are, not of who somebody else is. And or any kind of artist, like a novelist or a visual artist or a dancer, like, your job is to express you in the form of art.
Totally.
And because it's communication. And it's a funny thing. And I was going to ask you about the reception, particularly to the track Church Street Blues, because that's very much reimagined. And I know I interviewed Tristan Scroggins a while ago, and he said that he'd been chatting to you, and you'd said it was, you know, maybe the single most divisive thing you'd done in terms of the reaction to it. But it is so, and we had a long conversation about authenticity in music, and your version of Church Street Blues is not authentic to Tony's version, but it's utterly authentic to the spirit of Tony's version, which is take something and make it yours. And that's what counts, you know.
That was the idea. You know, and it's interesting because I think when we made this record and people kind of found out that we were doing it, I think a lot of people were really excited, like, oh, finally these guys are going to just play some bluegrass, you know, because we grew up playing bluegrass and we love it. And, you know, and we're good at it. It's like something that is a real part of what we do, but or who we are, I should say. I don't mean we're good at it in like a, but it's like, it's something that we all feel really comfortable with. You know, we grew up there. And I think, for us, there's kind of a sense of, you know, we wanted to interact with that record, like you say, in this, with the same kind of, curiosity and imagination that Tony kind of brought to it. Because if you listen to Tony's version of the song Church Street Blues as compared to Norman Blake's version, Norman, who of course wrote it, and Norman's version is completely epic as well. I mean, that's one of my favorite Norman Blake recordings, is him playing Church Street Blues. It's like, it's incredible. But Tony's version is super different. And so it kind of seemed really important for us to kind of reflect. It wouldn't be Punch Brothers if we just played it, if we tried to play a Tony version of the song. That's not, we, for better or worse, you know, have a different palette of things available to us as an ensemble. And so we kind of want to use those things and hopefully find something that we think is really beautiful and unique and that we would, you know, find fascinating or beautiful as listeners. But it's really not going to do that for everybody, which we're totally fine with. I think what there was, I mean, I wish I could say, I never look at YouTube or read the comments. I really do, because it's like just sad and narcissistic, like ever looking at comments, you know. But I definitely looked at the comments on that. And you know, a lot of people liked it, but there were people who were like angry about it. There were like a number of people who like it pissed them off. And I think that, I don't know. I'm sorry that they feel that way, but not apologetic at all for doing kind of what we did to it, because what we did is exactly what Tony did, just in a different way. Yeah. And it's because Tony's version means so much to so many people that I think people almost, it's the same thing with traditional bluegrass versus like progressive bluegrass. I mean, it's funny that Tony is now like the kind of, is a traditionalist in terms, or has the modern day traditionalists kind of in that camp. But, you know, if you kind of think about longer back in bluegrass, traditionalists wanted to play it just like Bill Monroe and Flat and Scruggs and the Stanley Brothers. And, you know, the Seldom Scene, for instance, like, you know, my father's band, or people like that were you know, it was also offensive to a lot of people, but to a lot of people it wasn't. And I think that's just the thing, the music kind of just tumbles forward through time in that way. And I think that's okay.
And you can't, like, I ended up doing a sort of short episode of the podcast just purely about the reaction to that song in the end, because like, you can't ruin a song. You can't do it. It's not possible. A song is an idea. It's not a fixed. It's not like a painting you can take a chunk out of, or a cathedral you can lop a wall off. It's, a song is only ever an idea until you commit it to tape, and then it's your version of an idea. So, like, you can't, whatever you do, you cannot undermine somebody else's joy at Tony's version or Norman's version or somebody else's version. It's just, you know.
Well, those things are still there. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, no, they haven't gone anywhere, and thank God, because like there's no one who loves that more than I do. Like I don't want to have to listen to the Punch version only ever for the rest of my life just because we recorded it that way. I'm glad it exists, but I will be listening to Church Street Blues, the song and the album, for the rest of my life, you know, as just kind of a well of inspiration and just, boy, just being close to Tony in that way. It's incredible. It's incredible that, you know, you can do that.
And did the reception feel different? Because I know, and I mean, then the documentary, the How to Grow a Band documentary, may not be an accurate representation of what went on at that time. But I remember watching that and seeing you in a cab on the way to the Bush Hall gig in London, which I was at. But you'd played in Glasgow the night before, and you know, Blind Leaving the Blind hadn't gone down a storm, and you were questioning, you know, do we break it up? Do we do this with it? Do we that? You know, how? And in the end, my memory of the gig is that it went down an absolute storm in London. But that's, I guess, that's your music, not a treasured, you know, it's not, you're doing that, breaking new ground.
Well, I think what it always has to do with, in that kind of situation, it always has everything to do with expectations. And I mean, we can extrapolate that and just talk about like wider life lessons. You know, you get, things become painful if you have expectations that aren't met. Whereas if you're kind of open to whatever it is, and you don't bring expectations to the table, then everything just can be accepted as it is what it is. And you might be like, this is for me, this is not for me. But I think, you know, when we did that gig in Glasgow, it was, people were kind of setting it up and setting up that music, promoters were, as something that it wasn't. So Thiele, who'd just been in Nickel Creek, and who were like the most, you know, popular band on the scene then, and very young and poppy, and you know, it was like, okay, he's got a new band now, and it's a bluegrass band. There's like banjo, and you know, it's like it more is it's Chris Thiele, this incredible musician with a bluegrass band, and so people, I think, were expecting a bluegrass band. And it wasn't at all. It was, you know, in many ways, probably to this day, the most ambitious thing we've ever done, at least in terms of the structure of it. And so I think there were people in the audience who kind of came and wanted to have a good time. And it was like, it was chamber music. It was that, that first record was straight up chamber music that had real, you know, influences from kind of bluegrass and string band music. And it was these instruments, but it was not kind of toe tapping good time stuff. It was like 40 minutes of through composed music. And so we were jeered at that gig. There are some people, you know, just shouting out, not much. I mean, here's the other thing, that review got a 5-star review in like the Scottish Herald, whatever the main newspaper is in Glasgow. The big newspaper gave us a 5 out of 5-star review. So it's not as if that show was a complete failure, but it was the first time that I personally had ever been in an onstage experience where people in the audience were like angry and like, and yelling at us, I shouldn't say yelling, but they were jeering us, like, do you know any good tunes, lads? Or like, you know, things like that, just at the quietest moment. And for that music, that really kind of gets in there and messes with your ability to focus and concentrate. But so I think it has everything to do ultimately with expectations.
It's funny because I was the afternoon of that London show, I was at a friend's house. We were working together and he said, oh, what are you doing tonight? I said, I'm going to a gig. And he said, oh, I might come with you. And I said, right, yeah, okay. It'll be an interesting gig to come too cold. And he's like, I'll come. And afterwards he was like, God, I didn't know music could do that. That was incredible. But he'd never heard of any of you, hadn't heard any of the music, had no, like, you know, no preconceptions whatsoever. And like, he's sort of a lifelong fan now. And that was
cool.
Kind of a remarkable
thing. Thank you.
You know, and it was just brilliant. Cause I was a bit nervous cause I knew what to expect. Cause I'd read a bit about what was in progress and that this was a through composed bit of chamber music basically. But it was beautiful. It was like, you know, it's such a cool thing to see it live. We'll be right back with you just after this. Collings Guitars has been a long time supporter of the bluegrass community, from collaborating with artists to sponsoring festivals big and small, and now by sponsoring Bluegrass Jamalong. Handmade in Austin, Texas, every Collings guitar and mandolin that leaves the shop is built from the sound up, and the team loves seeing a Collings in the hands of players of all levels, from local musicians to world-renowned pickers. Visit collingsguitars.com for more. This episode is also brought to you by Peghead Nation, the home of roots music instruction. with 65 streaming video courses for guitar, mandolin, banjo, fiddle, dobro, bass and ukulele from some of the leading names in acoustic music, Peghead Nation has something for every picker. You'll learn the tunes and techniques you need to join in at jams and play the music you love, plus advanced techniques like improvisation, theory and ear training. Your first course is just $20 per month and you can add more for $10 a month. Sign up for any course and get your first month free with the promo code JAMALONG, all one word. Join thousands of other players, including me, who are advancing on their instruments and having more fun playing the roots music they love at pegheadnation.com.
Thank you. Well, that was a that was such fun music to play. I mean, I think we all felt like zealots or like missionaries or something like that. When Thiele first got in touch about doing that, man, that was so exciting because he, you know, obviously he's just, the whole world knows how brilliant Chris Thiele is. It's like, in a way, it's easy to almost take for granted how expansive his mind is because he's just been around now for a long time. But that was, you know, for someone like me, I knew him a little bit, but that was a really exciting phone call to get. Like, hey, I want to do this thing. I want to do this really ambitious project. It wasn't going to be a band at that point. It was just going to be his next solo record. And, you know, I want to get like young guys, you know, would you be part of it? And we were all really excited about it. And then the music that he was writing, boy, that was super exciting too, because nobody really written music that sounded like that for these instruments before. So there was this real excitement kind of in the early days of, I mean, we all just practiced so much and worked so hard on that music because we felt like, man, what a beautiful opportunity. This is so, cool and special to bring this crazy music that no one's imagined before to life. It was a really special time. It was a really cool period.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, you've sort of mentioned the arrangement is almost as much a part of the songs as the song is with Punch Brothers. I was going to ask what the sort of the difference between the role of being a guitar player in Punch Brothers versus like a band like the String Dusters, or because it does feel like you know, you've said before that there's not always a lot of improvisation. It's very kind of, you know, very arranged and a lot of it's very premeditated.
I mean,
it's a different kind of guitar role to a lot of bluegrass bands.
Very much so. I mean, in some ways, yes. And in other ways, no. You can kind of look at it from different levels. On kind of a technical transcribable level, yes, it's pretty different. Not always. I mean, there's some songs that are a lot more flexible and we kind of will play a little bit more like a tune, but a lot of our music, like I'm playing a part that, there's a guitar part that's going to work, and it's going to work because it's going to interlock with the bass part and the banjo part and the mandolin part and the fiddle part. And they all are kind of going to have that relationship to each other. And I feel like that's not, part of the core DNA of bluegrass in any way, shape or form. You know, I mean, it sort of is, you know, you could say, well, sure, the mandolin, you know, in the original bluegrass template, the mandolin's chopping on 2 and 4, and that's really, you can expect that. And the bass is often on 1 and 3, or it might be, if you go back to the real original bluegrass, like Walking, you know, with like Bill Monroe back in the day. So there are kind of some templates that you can expect, but in Punch, it's a lot tighter and more refined, to where each part is providing some harmonic, rhythmic, melodic, and a combination of all of those functions at any given time. And it's all kind of how it fits together. Whereas, okay, playing with the Dusters, which was really fun. And I loved being a member of that band and I love those guys. That was a really, joyful, special, I think back on that time too. That was a really special, beautiful time as well. But that was really different. We were essentially playing songs, and there were songs that were a little more sophisticated than than a lot of bluegrass, but they were still kind of songs. It's like, here are the chords. And so as a rhythm guitar player, you know, I could kind of try to respond in the moment a lot more to what somebody else did, either by changing my voicing or changing a syncopation or you know, there's just a lot more there. You know, and I kind of think of playing bluegrass that way is it's almost like playing jazz. This is the analogy I use a lot. You know, being like a bluegrass guitar player can be a little bit like being a jazz drummer. If you think about a drummer in jazz, Elvin Jones or, you know, Roy Haynes or anybody, they're very rarely just timekeepers playing a beat. You know, they instead will kind of, they're keeping the beat going. They're keeping the music flowing forward. But there's a lot of interaction, there's a lot of reaction, there's a lot of commentary to what else is happening in the rest of the ensemble. And the ensemble kind of swirls around itself. There might be somebody who's a soloist who's kind of up in front, but the ensemble is actively engaged in creating music together at kind of all time, like it creatively creating music together. And I feel like you can do that in bluegrass. I feel like that's what Tony Rice was so great at. I mean, to me, Tony as a rhythm guitar player, that's what just still blows my mind. I mean, Tony as a soloist is incredible, and the what power he played with and the clarity is unbelievable. But I could, you know, I could let that go if I had to choose that or just the rhythm guitar. I'd somehow have the rhythm guitar because the way that he was able to participate in the ensemble and lift up his fellow musicians was unreal and unbelievable. And that's something that I kind of learned about from Tony, and that's something I've really tried to study as a rhythm guitar player. You know, I'm not half as good at it as Tony is, but that's something that's always been really important to me. I've tried to be a guitar player who can hopefully get in there and I don't want to call it magic, but that's kind of how Bela describes Tony's playing. He said he could just bring a little extra magic into the situation. So that to me is like the highest calling of bluegrass guitar, is that you don't just strum the chords. You know, when it gets to like a higher level art, you kind of make the music more rich and you help do things that are going to help everybody to play better. I don't feel like I do that in a transcribable way in Punch Brothers so much. But then if we kind of, you know, I said you could look at these on two different levels. So it can be a lot more interactive in the moment playing bluegrass. Punch Brothers, the parts might be a little more defined. But if you kind of zoom up and zoom out a little bit, I think the headspace that you're in doing both of those things is kind of identical, which is you are listening. You're not a person who's doing the music or making it happen. You can kind of get to this headspace of being an observer, kind of like an active participant, but really it's almost like the listening is the most important part. Like in Punch, I obviously am playing those parts and I'm obviously trying to make them breathe, and I'm trying to make the music have a heartbeat in the same way that I would try to be kind of in the middle of the music and make the music have a heartbeat in a bluegrass band. But it's not something that I feel like I can try to control too much. The common thing for both of those to do them, what I feel based on my experiences, is like the best way I know how to do it is to kind of zoom out and have the perspective of being of having the best seat in the house and kind of listening to the music and loving it as it unfolds and trying to, and you know, you're a part of that, you know, you're like, you're playing. And I feel like when you come at it from that perspective, it's easier to make that magic happen, whatever that thing is that is difficult to define. And it's not always there. I mean, Lord knows, like, I wish I could have that all the time, and a lot of times I can't. It's just like playing the parts. But when it's all going well, I feel like that perspective, what you're doing, the role you're, or your experience of the role you're playing, is not really very different. You know, whether I'm playing something like Movement and Location or Clara or some Punch song like that, or, you know, Little Cabin Home on the Hill. I mean, I don't actually get to play much straight ahead bluegrass like that, but even like something, the Punch Brothers would play, like, that might be a little closer to that, like Hops of Guldenberg or the 11th Reel, like some of these things that are tunes that are a little more connected to that sort of thing.
Well, that's really interesting. Cause it's the, as somebody who has, you know, obviously never seen Tony Rice play or meet him, just the, when all the tributes and all the podcasts and videos and interviews were sort of coming out at the beginning of the year, the thing that I was most struck by was the way everybody talked about his rhythm playing and the sort of the space and platform he created for other people and how then that, I found that fascinating because, you know, we, most bluegrass players spend most of their time practicing melody and taking breaks and not much time practicing rhythm. And that's mostly what you're going to do as a guitar player is play rhythm.
Yeah.
And just to hear people talk about that, I found that really sort of enlightening. I went back and listened to it all with sort of fresh ears. And I interviewed Marcel from Lessons with Marcel, the YouTube channel.
Oh, yeah.
And he was saying he'd sort of seen this clip and somebody had asked Tony to demonstrate his rhythm style. And he said, well, I can't do it because there's nobody else here. I can't do it on my own. And that's such a remarkable, this guy, I can't show you how to play rhythm guitar because there's nobody else to play with.
Yeah, it was completely interactive, completely reactive. And yeah, he did. He made everybody play better because it wasn't just his time feel, although his time feel was unreal. It's like, for me, man, you know, I can get all the chords and the note, like that stuff I can do, and all the stuff Tony could do, but I can't get the feel. I've tried my whole life. I can't make it feel like that. I just can't do it. And I wish I could. I would, you know, but it's like, so with Tony, it's just that feeling that he had for it was, man, it was like, I don't know. It made everybody sore. Another thing that I heard Bela say about Tony, that I loved was he said is like stepping onto a magic carpet. It's just like you step onto this thing and you just like start flying. You didn't know that you could just be on this thing and then you start flying. But yeah, but you know, the thing that kind of caught my ear that I could do was, and that Tony does so beautifully is like play all these different colors, like bring all these interesting colors to bear as well as that kind of rhythmic touch. And that's so cool. I mean, one of my favorite records, maybe my favorite record for that is the Bluegrass Sessions, Tales from the Acoustic Planet Part 2, the record that they made. And I, you know, listening to the rhythm guitar on that record and it's, to me, it's not necessarily about Tony's feel on that record. And part of this might be how Bela edited it because Bela edits stuff a lot and he'll go and try and get all the best parts. And it feels great on there, but it's, that to me is not, that record's fascinating from a kind of rhythm guitar content perspective. Because you can tell that Bela was like getting in there and just like the coolest little thing, like where did that come from? It's all over on that record. And it's really fun to kind of put that record on and just listen through and pay attention to the rhythm. It's beautiful, totally beautiful.
And I think that what that sort of says about any musician is I think the thing that we forget as musicians is listening. Because we're so keen to, it's like the sort of metaphor of music as a language and you're trying to communicate something. We're so busy trying to show people what we can do and what we can say that it, like in conversation, we forget to listen and to express anything. It has to be in response to something somebody else has said. You can't just drop interesting thoughts you've got in your head into a conversation and make an interesting experience. And I think the listening side of being a musician is so, it's like being a writer, you need to read a lot. Being a musician, you need to listen not just while you're not playing, but while you're playing. And it's almost a separate skill in a way that some people have just got a really developed ear and a developed ability or willingness to do it. And it can make such a difference.
Well, I think what it all has in common is a real love of music. You know, I think to be a great musician, to be a great player, or I mean, there's a lot of different ways to be a great musician. But because there are a lot of great musicians who have made a lot of great music and they've all done it differently. But I think coming from the perspective of loving music, anybody who really loves music is going to, and loves the sound that they make, is going to make something that's worth hearing, you know? And again, it might not be for you, but if somebody's in actively in that place of loving the being a music fan, while they're playing music, then it's going to be worth listening to. And being a music fan, you know, that the way we become music fans in the first place is by listening to music. You know, that's kind of what I grew up just surrounded by great music. It was one of the kind of happy accidents of my life, is that not only, you know, growing up around the Seldom Scene and just having these amazing musicians around, that was incredible because it provided a model of, like, you can be a real actual human being, not just somebody that I've seen on a poster or a screen, mm-hmm. and make great music. Like, so that to me was a big lesson, that, but just to hear those guys all the time. And my mom, who is like, just a deep lover of music. And that comes from her parents. Her parents kind of met through a love of classical music. I mean, neither one of them were players, but they kind of lived for classical music and jazz, but mostly classical music. And so growing up, it was like music, especially with my mom, was like a religion. You know, I spent a lot of, my parents were divorced. They got divorced when I was very young, and they were very amicable and everything was totally cool. But I spent a lot of time with my mom. And we would just drive around in the car listening to this incredible stuff. And like so much Oscar Peterson and Joni Mitchell and, well, the David Grisman Quintet and Glenn Gould playing all kinds of Bach, you know, and that I was just lucky that was part of my environment. I kind of learned, there was all this great curation that happened in my environment. And so I didn't have to do anything. The great music was there and I just loved it because it was awesome. But I feel like it starts with that. It starts with, again, not to be self-referential, but I think that, you know, I felt like I was kind of a musician, or I really cared deeply about music from the time I was like 5 years old. I didn't start playing music or doing any of that till I was 9 or 10. But I was as serious about music when I was, you know, 5 or 6 as I was when I started playing it as a listener, you know.
I did a similar sort of experience, except there were no musicians in my house when I grew up, but there was a lot of music and a lot of variety of music. I remember being sort of, you know, 4 or 5 and listening to the Beatles and wondering why my friends didn't listen to the Beatles. And we had Buddy Holly and the Stones, but my dad listened to a lot of classical music and he'd listen to Miles Davis and there'd be, you know, and even within the classical stuff, there was a range from Wagner to Plain Chant to Benjamin Britten to, like, it was all over the place. And you just sort of absorb it a bit, don't you? And I sort of thought of myself as a musician years before I ever played an instrument. But in my head, this was something I was going to do one day. You know,
it's a world, you know, it's this whole world that you have access to that no one can ever take away from you, but you can just close your eyes and it's there.
And I think that's a really interesting thing, because just through the people that I've interviewed for the podcast, but also reading about people and listening to other interviews, there seems to be a really strong theme of musicians who grew up around musical parents. You know, you think about Brian Sutton and his dad, Billy Strings and his dad, Justin Moses played with his family band, Molly Tuttle, like, you know, it seems to be a real thread of a lot of musicians grew up not only being incredibly encouraged by their parents, but also their parents being able to participate in it in some way. Yeah. Just having access to instruments and things like that, you know,
it's a big deal. Yeah. I mean, that was something that I got to do with both of my parents, you know, cause my mom was a banjo player too. That's how they met. I was, you know, say that it's miraculous that I actually grew, you know, came out with 10 fingers and 10 toes. But like, yeah, getting to do that with them when I was a kid was so fun. It was like, it's such a great way to participate, have something you actually do with your folks. I'll tell you, when I got older too, and was more serious, getting to play with my dad in the Seldom Scene, which fully started out as like pure nepotism, but but kind of turned into, I was like good enough to be there, but there's no reason that there should ever have been a lead guitar player in the Seldom scene. But the fact that I got to have that time with my dad in my early 20s, I mean, because there was a while where they hired me on, like I was a full-time member of the band. Like I was getting, there were six members of the full-on members of the Seldom scene for a little while. And that was incredible. But what was the most special about it was just getting to have this time bonding with my father and hitting the road. We'd travel together. I feel like a lot of people don't get to do that in their lives, especially their older lives, is to have that kind of quality time. And it was really, magical, really, really special. Cause we always had a, you know, really good relationship, and he lived literally four blocks from my mom when I was growing up. I mean, we were very, everybody was cool, but I, you know, I really lived with my mom. I'd go with my dad on weekends sometimes, and to get to have that experience that music was the reason when I was older was really great.
Yeah, I mean, it must be lovely. And I guess it sort of leads into the other thing I was going to ask you about is sort of that idea of sort of coming full circle again to the point where, like, the other new thing in your life now is teaching artist works and being able to be in the position of sort of mentoring somebody else and passing. And there's a real strong, I mean, I love what they do at Artist Works, but it's a strong thread throughout the bluegrass world is that there aren't really many great players who consider themselves too good to teach or too good to pass things on. There's no sense that, almost no sense that the two things are separate things, that if you've, as you said at the beginning, if you've sort of been able to jam with your idols when you're a kid and learn, it's just the idea that part of your job is to then give that back to the next generation almost.
Yeah, it's a huge part of the community. It's a big part of what makes this music tick. And yeah, I mean, Artist Works, I'm very excited about that because it baked into the platform is the whole VE video exchange thing, which, by the way, I've got one. The next one I got to film is yours. I filmed it the other night and then my camera died halfway through. Curses technology. So I gotta get inspired and give you another one. But this idea that you can kind of interact and kind of give people tailored advice to what they're up to is really cool. I love that. I love nobody told me to do this, but I kind of love the freedom on there to just be like, okay, I'm a teacher. So you might have even asked me about this question, but we're going to talk about that a little bit. But here's what I think we actually should be talking about, or the neat core issue underneath, which I think Artist Works is cool that way because it's not just a curriculum online that you go the first this step and that step. I mean, all that stuff's wonderful as well, and that kind of gives you a lattice to hang the other stuff off of. But I love that. I enjoy teaching. I mean, teaching's always been something that I've liked doing. I think, you know, getting somebody to have kind of a light bulb moment, what a beautiful thing to share, you know, to share something that might cause someone else to feel switched on or excited or kind of have this, you know, discovery where they can then kind of burrow into it on their own. And that to me is what teaching is all about. I kind of feel like you can't actually teach anybody anything directly. Ultimately, people have to learn things on their own, but you can be a great guide, and I feel like that's what it is to be a teacher, is to be a guide. Like I've gone down this road. Let me point you in some directions that might really get you interested, or how the question for as the teacher is like, how can I share this piece of information that someone then might be able to take and run with? Because I think that's where the real kind of profound learning is, and that's I love that. I love doing that.
Yeah, and it's almost like parenting. I've got a 9-year-old son, and he's, you know, I can't turn him into any kind of person he's not going to be himself. I can only sort of point his head in certain directions and go, look at that, that might be handy, or look at that, that's cool, or I got this wrong, so I'm telling you about it, so you've got the option to see it coming, or whatever. But I think that's the thing, that's the joy of artist works, is that bit of personalized. I mean, I started getting lessons from Brian Sutton, just over a year ago maybe, and I sort of showed up thinking, yeah, this is great, I'm going to play something, and Brian's going to show me some really cool licks, and this is going to be exciting. And the first thing he said was, you know, move your arm, it's in the wrong place. And I promise you, if you spend a couple of weeks getting used to it, it's going to sound better. And I did. Yeah. But that's not what I came to him for. And I was one of the lucky people who was asked to sort of demo your lessons before they launched, just to kind of give them a once over. And then I had a few weeks free after that just to play around with it. And I did. And I sent you a VE. And the immediate response, I unlocked something. And I was like, well, I'm going to sign up for a year of this as well then. Because just those moments of just being able to come to you for something. And sometimes, like, I'm sure most of us in artists works at some point have submitted a video just to sort of show you that we think we're good, just to go, I'd like you to think I'm a good guitar player is the only thing I want you to do. And and actually, when you least are asking a question is sometimes when you get the best answer, if you know what I mean. Somebody just sees something in what you're playing and can say, have you thought about this? Or, and it's just those, I think I could have sat and played in front of videos with no interaction for a year or two and become a better player, but I wouldn't have had any of those moments that then send me off on a little journey of exploration to see where I could go.
That to me is what's so fun about playing guitar are those journeys of exploration. You know, that I still, it's not for me. I don't pick up the guitar as much as I did when I was a kid. Like, when I was younger, you couldn't keep it out of my hands. And now, if I'm not, it's sort of like going to the gym. You know, if I've been going to the gym a lot, then I feel a compulsion to go to the gym. But if I've fallen off of it, I might go 2 weeks and not exercise, you know. And guitar for me can be like that now. I mean, there are definitely times during this pandemic when I probably didn't touch it for a couple weeks. But I feel like once I can kind of get going on it again, that same kind of childlike curiosity, it's always still there. And that's kind of what I live for. I mean, to me, there are a few sides of music that make it just special and worthwhile. One is just as a listener, like, again, that you can put on some headphones and close your eyes and be just transported to a different world. It can be this beautiful transcendent experience, and you just, your normal reality is gone and you're somewhere else. Like, that's amazing. Okay, that's like check one in the music column. And again, I say this all the time, but it's so true. No one can ever take that away from you. That's this thing that you've got. But also just the curiosity, the transcendent world you can get into if you allow your curiosity to be piqued is so cool and special. Like, to me, I can still just pick up the guitar. I just did this yesterday. This is like kind of a dorky sounding thing, but whatever, it was interesting to me. I was messing around. And by the way, if anybody's thinking about, this isn't actually like, you know, Matt asked me if I wanted to do this podcast. This wasn't like, okay, let's chill for Artist Works. But I will say, this is not what my Artist Works course consists of. But I was like, okay, let me just mess around with harmonizing modes of the harmonic minor scale and see what crazy sounds come out. Because it yields all these like amazing chord, you know, these sounds, you know, you get a minor chord, and then you get a diminished chord, and then you get an augmented chord, and you get another minor chord, and you get two major chords that are half step apart, and you play those together. And I'm going to grab my guitar and show you, because this was just so fun for me. Hang on. I'm going to mess it up because I'm, you know, just was learning this stuff. But yeah, this idea that you could have, what is it? Uh, Like that is just this scale, this harmonic minor scale, which is just those notes. And anyway, it's just taking each of those notes and skipping every other note. So this one, skip this one. So you got those two. And then you, from this note, you skip one. You got that. So, and then you just move up to the next note in the scale. Ah, how beautiful is that? Like, this whole world that I just am not well versed in. And it just piqued my curiosity. I just thought, like, gosh, like, that's just pretty. And it makes me feel things. It makes me feel things. And I want to know more about that. And so, I don't know. You can always do that.
And you can get it from there. You know, you can get it from such simple things as well. You can get it from complex things. But I remember being in a band years ago and just thinking, I wonder how far through this song I can get just playing two notes an octave apart and nothing else.
Yeah.
And like, just go, I'm going to try and get all the way through this song, and I'm all going to play as an E an octave above it. And
yeah,
you get to a point where you go, yeah, okay, that's not going to work all the way through. But we ended up, the entire first verse of a song was just two notes, you know, in the back. Okay. And you just find a little thing and go, right, let's go and dig and see where we end up. It's just a joyous thing.
Totally. To give yourself constraints like that can be a really, really powerful creative tool. Just play something on one string, you know, see what happens and try and make music happen. It'll challenge you if you're just kind of playing, if you kind of in the habit of just letting your fingers go. If you give yourself the constraint of like, you got one or two strings and a few frets, then you kind of, your muscle memory isn't just going to take care of it. You kind of have to start thinking a little bit differently, and it kind of just, it gets you to engage, your I'm blanking on this word too. Anyway, you have to engage. It's like MacGyver. You remember the show MacGyver?
Yeah.
What is this term I'm thinking of that MacGyver was the master of? He'd like have, you know, two, you know, paper clips and a clothes hanger and a gallon of milk, and he'd, you know, somehow make a parachute out of it. Resourceful. You have to. That's what MacGyver was, very resourceful. And so, as you know, musicians, it can be great to give yourself constraints like that, because it kind of switches your mode. It's enough. You make the constraint tight enough so that you're not going to have to deal with tons of information. You can kind of map it out relatively easily, but then you have to be resourceful and be musical within that. And that can be a really wonderful way to find stuff, you know, to pique your curiosity. And once your curiosity is piqued, then you can kind of open things back up a little bit and give yourself a little more room.
Yeah, and it's true. You can, that muscle memory thing, if it's easy just to sit down and start playing the same old stuff every time you pick a guitar up. And one of the tricks I've developed for getting me out of that is to take a fiddle tune that is in like a, you know, a reel or something that's in four and play it in jig time. Because you have to at least leave every fourth note out or make some changes to it. It sort of shocks me out of complacency a little bit, because I have to actually think again. You can't just play Whiskey for Breakfast. You've got to go, oh, hang on a minute. I've only got these six notes in the bar instead of eight now. Well, and then I've got to pick them differently. And oh God, I've got to think.
And yeah.
Because I can get really lazy otherwise.
Yeah. It's really good. Yeah. Whatever you have to, it's like whatever works, you know. And again, to bring it to the gym analogy, it's like, running works great for some people. You know, I love it because I can just walk out my front door and go. Other people go to the gym and work out. It works for them. Mm. So it's kind of, I feel like a lot of this stuff is, you kind of find, you figure out what piques your curiosity. You figure out what you can become invested in. And that's kind of the most fertile ground to kind of explore. You don't, Julian Lage has this great thing that he says about improvising, that he always says that, you know, there's this myth that in order to improvise, you have to go to jazz hell and back and learn every mode and every arpeggio and every set, whatever. And he says, it's just not true. That's just simply not true. You just have to play. You just have to be, you know. And it is true. You basically, you have to be willing to step off into the unknown and learn how to embrace that and learn to embrace mistakes and learn to embrace failure, because it's not actually failure. That's just, you just think it is.
I remember reading Julian wrote an article that was sort of 12 observations on the guitar or whatever, and one of them was to listen to your, like, to improvise and record it and listen back and look for the things that you do, like, you tend to do regularly. Because I'm the same. I when I improvise, I just beat myself up for not sounding like I think I should or whatever. And reading that sort of unlocked a thing. And Brian Sutton has done the same, of sort of pointed out things that I do that are me. And I tend to think of them as being stylistically incorrect because I don't sound like a bluegrass player when I do them. But he's like, no, those are the things that make you you. So lean into those. Do more of them. I like those. Yeah. They're the good stuff.
Exactly.
And I am sort of constantly holding myself up to this weird template of the kind of guitarist they think I ought to be. And he's going, just be the one you are.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's it. I mean, well, that, to go back to Tony's thing, I mean, that's what Tony did. You know, Tony had bluegrass in his blood and he had jazz in his blood, and all those things were what he just simply, those were him. And he did the work and kind of brought it out. But that's not to say that that's what, those are the notes that you would have or the perspective that you would have. And I think that's just really true for all of us. You kind of want to lean into who you are and what you do. I mean, it's a funny thing. A lot of musicians will avoid the thing that they do well. Mm. I mean, and you can make this argument for Punch Brothers, like I was saying earlier, like, why, you know, we could and probably should just make a record sometime of us just playing straight ahead music where we're not, you know, like, that would kind of be interesting to me to hear, or at least to be a part of, like, what would it be with this band? You know, what would it be with those guys? You can kind of get into a thing where, even though that's sort of like falling off a log, you don't want to do that thing because you tend to undervalue things that you can do without much effort.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the How to Grow a Woman from the Grand album feels a bit like that. Feels like sort of straight to music, and it is. Maybe that was part of the process of getting to know each other as musicians, so you could sort of stretch out and do the more detailed stuff. But there's a not a simplicity to that album, but there's a sort of directness to it. It's just a bunch of guys playing a bunch of instruments on a bunch of songs.
Well, that record too. I'm really fond of that record. That record. It's got 14 songs, and we rehearsed for 3 days and we recorded for 3 days, like from the first time we played the first note of the first song at rehearsal to the, when the album was done was 6 days. And so that, what I like about that record is that is just the sound of us, like, just getting it done. That's us just, like, you know, back against the wall, like, just playing music. Cause we didn't have time to mess around. Like, that was it. And it's fun. That was a really neat record for that reason. Really fun record to make. Ronnie McCurry was there for that record. He wasn't listed as the producer, but we called him our bluegrass guru. We wanted to make sure that he would be there, that we would have somebody to keep us in check in case we were getting too far afield. And so Ronnie kind of came up and was listening to playbacks and stuff. And
brilliant.
That was really cool.
Oh yeah, I love that record. It's a cool record. So that sort of looping back to Tony and individuality sort of brings us back full circle to where we started, really, which is maybe a nice point to think about wrapping up. But I'd really like to ask sort of what you've got coming next. Obviously, you've set aside time for Hell on Church Street coming out and be promo for that. And fingers crossed you'll be able to tour for that.
Yeah.
So that's probably going to take up most of this year, I'd guess.
Fingers are very much crossed for that. Yeah, that's going to be, you know, we're doing that in January, February, March, and then some in the summer and in the fall as far as touring. The album will be out. Another thing, we haven't mixed it yet, but we recorded it actually about a week and a half before we recorded Hell on Church Street, is another record that I'm really, really excited about. It is kind of a straight ahead bluegrass record. It's me and Noam and Greg Garrison, who was the original bass player in Punch, and Alex Hargraves, who is this really wonderful fiddler just unbelievable. And Andrew Marlin, who's the kind of guitar player, mandolin player, singer, songwriter for this band, Mandolin Orange. Yeah. Or actually, they used to, excuse me, I can't believe I just said that. They used to be called Mandolin Orange. They've changed it. They're now Watch House. So he's this guy from Watch House. But Andrew's an amazing musician. And we made sort of a, it's not quite straight ahead, but it's like relatively straight ahead record. That I'm really excited about. I think it's a cool record. And I don't know when that'll come out. I don't know. Maybe shouldn't even be spilling the beans about it, but, but that I'm genuinely psyched about. That's going to be a fun project too. So hopefully that, you know, we'll get it mixed and everything, and hopefully that'll come out in the not too distant future and we can play some shows with it.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I look forward to hearing that. That'd be great. Is there anything else you've got kind of going on at the moment? Or is that a pretty busy year ahead already by the sound of it?
I mean, you know, between artist works, and I teach at Oberlin College, where I went to school. So between those things and, let's see, I'm, you know, just, you know, normal old life stuff. Got the dogs. We've got a house where we've been renovating. You know, it's like all that kind of stuff is keeping us plenty busy.
Yeah. So, cool. Yeah. So what's the best place for me to send people to find out information on the various bits?
Gosh, you know, I would say my website, although I haven't updated it. Maybe I hit it once in the last 4 years, but basically, you know, my Facebook, my handle on all those things is Critter, because everybody calls me, or not everybody, but a lot of people call me Critter, Eldridge. And that's like to facebook.com/CritterEldridge. I think I'll get you there. And that's my Instagram handle. And that's good. And, you know, I do have a website, chriseldridge.net. Or actually, I think there's also crittereldridge.com. if I'm not mistaken, it's probably sent to the same place. But that are Punch Brothers and hopefully, by the way, hopefully Julian Lodge and I were going to do some touring in 2020. We had a tour booked and that got canceled. So and we've been talking about doing some other recording too, but the pandemic really kind of threw off the stuff with Jules, but we have plans that were sidelined. So they're still there. The plans waiting in the wings. It's just, we got to find the time to do it.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I love listening to you two play together.
It's my favorite. I mean, Julian is just, just such a beautiful person, and obviously such an unbelievable musician and guitar player. And you know, the funny thing about Julian, for as truly virtuosic and incredible and everything as he is, you never feel better about yourself as a guitar player. This speaks to him as a character than when you're playing with Julian. Like, how could that make sense? It doesn't typically work that way with people like that who are these like super virtuosos. But Julian is the most warm, empathetic, beautiful guy, and most warm, empathetic, beautiful musician. And he's very fierce too, obviously, you know, but I love playing with Jules, and I hope we get to do that again before too terribly long.
Well, if you do, I hope I get to see it at some point. So that'd be great.
We got to come to the UK at some point. Yeah, I don't know when we're going to do it, but we need to, there was talk about trying to do Celtic Connections at some point. So we'll see. One of these days we'll get over there.
Well, thanks so much for making the time to do this. It's been a delight. I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, totally. Thank you so much for inviting me on. And there's a VE coming your way, I promise.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Yeah. Cool. All right, Matt.
Well, there we have it. That was great. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Just such a joy talking to Chris, and thanks to him again for his time doing that. It was great. I'll stick some links in the show notes to Chris's stuff with Julian Lage, obviously to Punch Brothers as well, and I'll stick some links in there to Chris's artist work stuff too. I know particularly at the time of recording this, there are some really hefty discounts on that, so if you're thinking about getting some classes from Chris, which I would highly recommend, now is a good time to do it. But to be honest, any time is a good time to do it. Cool, that's it. I've got more interviews lined up. There's some really cool stuff coming up, actually, over the next couple of months. But I also am aware that I need to get back onto the tunes as well. So I'll be cracking on with that. But yeah, thanks for listening. Have a great week and happy picking. Bluegrass Jamalong is proud to be sponsored by Collings Guitars and Mandolins, making some of the finest guitars and mandolins in the world since the 1970s. Visit collingsguitars.com and find out why.